Real quick, I want to share some news about an exciting event coming up in October, Creative Sprint. Inspired by my own year-long Skull-A-Day project, my company, Another Limited Rebellion, has been hosting this fun, free 30-day challenge each fall to get everyone excited about the benefits of creative practice. So, how does this work? Sign up now at creativesprint.co, and starting on October 1st, we will email you a creative prompt each morning for 30 days. You're invited to interpret the prompt however you like and make something inspired by it. Then share your creations. It's that simple. You'll also get access to our private LinkedIn community where you can get inspired by fellow sprinters from across the globe. So head on over to creativesprint.co now to get signed up and discover how a small daily act of creativity can lead to amazing inspiration and transformation in your life and work. Welcome to episode 25 of Foreground Background with me, Noah Scalin. I'm an artist, author, and corporate creativity consultant, and today I'm interviewing Sonia Clark. Sonia is a Winifred L. Arms Professor of Art and Humanities at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Her work has been exhibited in over 450 museums and galleries across the globe, and she is a recipient of multiple awards and residencies. And you may have seen her work featured in the New York Times, Sculpture, Art in America, Time Magazine, Los Angeles Times, and so many, many others. In this hour-long conversation, we discuss navigating the complexity of humanity in the art world and its relation to marginalized communities, embracing different styles and methods in learning and teaching art, and so much more. I couldn't have made this podcast without my Team Art members on Patreon. The regular writing and reflection I do for my Patreon page has me thinking deeper about the issues that artists and creative folks of all sorts have to contend with. I've been talking with fellow working creatives to get their perspective, and once I started having these conversations, I realized that others could benefit from them as well. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a comment, let me know what resonates with you, and give it a thumbs up or a five-star review wherever you listen to it. And of course, if you're not already a Team Art member, I hope you'll check it out at patreon.com/noahscalin. For as little as $5 a month, you get behind-the-scenes access to my art studio, including content available nowhere else. Hi, Sonia. You know, I've been trying to get you on this podcast for a long time.
Well, it's been a crazy world and a crazy time, but I'm happy to be here with you now.
Admittedly. Yeah, no, I think you were actually one of the first people I wanted to interview.
That's nice. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, it's because I am a huge fan of you. I think your artwork is incredibly inspiring, and it's something that I aspire to be at the level that you're at in terms of your combination of your activism and your practice and your materials usage is just phenomenal. So
thank you. I truly appreciate that. Clearly you haven't seen all my work because there's lots of failure in there. But, you know, like I always say this, like you need the manure for the things to grow.
Thank you. So you've spoken like a true artist too, when you've given a compliment, like, let me tell you about the bad stuff. Let me make sure you understand the reality.
I love it. If I don't have a bunch of things that I think are excrement, I know that I'm not doing something, you know, like I really truly believe that you need that stuff for the good stuff to grow.
Yeah, see, really I do. Knew this is why I wanted to talk to you. A font of wisdom. Everything is a gem here. Okay. So, gosh, there's so much to talk about. The way I like to do this is sort of take us on a journey of your life as an artist. So let's go all the way back and say, as a child, did you think that you'd be an artist? Did you want to be an artist? Was that something you thought about? Was that on the list?
No, not in particular, but I will say this. I went to Montessori school. So already, if you know anything about Montessori, that's a way of learning that is very experiential. So when I think about that, I think like, well, I was being trained to experience a world through multisensorially, which is something that's very important. to me and to many of us who are in the fields of art. And I say fields, I'm not just talking about visual art, because this is not privileging the visual. Like the way that Montessori would teach kids how to learn their alphabet, they understood that a small child couldn't necessarily hold a pencil. And so you would trace letters that were sandpaper letters, so you could really feel them, right? So like an A would be written in sandpaper on a blank card, but the A would be in sandpaper. And that actually, I had many, many years later when I was a young college professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was studying Braille for a project, and I had this multisensorial experience where I was studying Braille and I was smelling the beach, and my and I was like, what is happening in my brain? I mean, like, I had to tell you, like, I was smelling the beach. So I called my parents. My father was a psychiatrist, my mom a nurse, and I really wanted to talk to my dad as a shrink. I was like, what is happening in my brain that I'm touching something and smelling something? My dad wasn't home, but I shared this with my mom, and my mom got like angry at me for studying Braille, because she said, it's like you're tempting the universe to take away your eyesight.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
And so this is my mother remembering that as a very small child, I had very bad eyes. I've been wearing glasses since I was quite young. And she was just like, you know, like, don't do this. But then I said, okay, Mom, can you get over that? Because what actually is happening is this weird multisensorial thing where I'm learning Braille and I'm smelling the beach. And my mother, who has just gone off about how I shouldn't learn Braille because it would make me blind, like that sort of twisted logic, says, oh, that makes perfect sense. And she said, and it's not the beach. So she corrected me. She said, it's not the beach, it's sandpaper. So now you know the beginning of the story. I've sort of buried, you know, like told you the end of the story at the beginning. But she remembered me, you know, the thing about parents, and I know you're a parent, is that we have the privilege with parents of people knowing us before we knew ourselves, right? Yeah. So my mother knew that I had had this learning experience. So she said, you're learning another textual language, and it's your brain is just going, oh, remember when we learned this before? Remember when we were doing this before? And of course, the reason I was studying Braille is because I was interested in the tactile senses, the relationship between text and textile, the relationship between touch and the haptic, not privileging the optic and that sort of thing. Where did all of that get born?
Right.
Probably from Montessori school. So, I mean, we could start there. It could just be sort of happenstance. It could be genetic. Who knows all the people who made me? Who knows who of my, like epigenetically, who of my ancestors who were in me, with me right now, in my blood and bones, who were artists? I mean, I come from people who are incredibly, and here I'm speaking broadly as a person of African descent, that are, incredible, filled with ingenuity, right? So it also feels like my responsibility, right, to be an artist. And then I'll say that my Montessori school teacher said to my mother that she was an artist, and she said that I was going to be an artist. But I think people say that about kids all the time because kids are so open. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll say about like early childhood is that when I often will say to my students, as a way of getting to know each other in the classroom, I ask them to recount, I pair them up and I ask them to recount their first artful experience. And I don't say their first art experience, I say artful experience, and that, you know, their first experience with art, but artful experience, to see where it leads them. Because some of them will do, you know, school. So some of them are like, it's the first time I saw a Picasso at the Met, and they think that that's the right answer. But my first artful experience is a child with very poor eyesight who was using a pencil to feel the wall. And I mean that, like I wasn't drawing on the wall as much as I was feeling that sort of the way that a wall when painted with a roller is almost like our skin. You know, and so I was using that pencil point the way that a record would, the way that a needle is on a record player. And again, my mother was lost her mind. They had just painted this wall and she's like, you know.
Right.
But I drew her in and she said, "What are you doing?" And I explained to her in, you know, toddler language that I was feeling the wall. And I drew her into my artful moment. And I do remember that. I remember that my mom was yelling and she calmed down when I could draw her into the experience that I was having. So I would say that first artful moment is also something that we try to do as artists. Sorry, that was a long answer to a very short question.
No, that's amazing. And I think, I mean, that's a profound thing to experience when you're young and say, wow, this is the power of art right here. And obviously you were very lucky because your parents are sending you to a Montessori school. So I'm assuming they were supportive of your interest in art and art making of some sort at a young age.
I should say at a young age, everybody is.
Well, sure.
And then you get to another age and they're like, okay.
Okay, so this is what I want to know.
First generation American, we gave up, you know, like family and home and comfort and, you know, all of that to move to this this place that, this racist nation, and you want to do art. So here's the thing, you know, like there weren't many models.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up with a sense that art would make you sort of maybe well-rounded, but it wasn't supposed to be your profession.
Right.
And I think that's just because, like any parents, your parents hope for a kind of stability. They hope that their children's lives are as better than theirs, if possible. That the struggle, if they had struggle, that there's a little bit more ease for the next generation. So I didn't study art until, you know, relatively late in life. My first degree isn't in art. My first degree is in psychology, and then I went to art school and got a second bachelor's degree. And my father was like, college was expensive and you had a job and you want to do what now? And what he said to me was, I worked for 2 years and he said, well, I know I've taught you how to save money. He was very good at teaching me how to do that. So he said, I know I've taught you how to save money. So if you want to do this art school thing, that's great. You have some money, right? So go ahead and do that. His caveat was that no matter what, again, it was a second bachelor's degree. So to him, it was like this, why would you do something over? And then why would you do art? And he was like, you know, you're 20 some, this is what 20 year olds here in this country do. They, you know, try and find themselves or whatever. And he said, great, just promise me that you will go to graduate school no matter what. You know, he's like, I just want you to get to the next level. And I went to the Art Institute of Chicago and found more oxygen in the air there than I had found in other places. And it was also the hardest learning environment that I had ever been in. And there were no grades. I knew how to get good grades as a student. And so I was in this institution where there were no grades. So how do you know what is valuable and what is worthwhile? What is good, what is not good? How do you judge all of those things? It's turned everything upside down. And art is still the hardest thing that I do. And so my parents didn't really buy in until I got my first job as a professor, because, you know, honestly, that's something they could tell their friends. She's a professor now, you know? And then they were just like, someone's paying her to teach people how to do art. So... maybe she's also an artist. And I regret that they're not in the world now. My parents are both ancestors, because anything that feels like a minor success or achievement is really an honor to them. You know, my closest ancestors, and for them not to be physically here to witness it, it feels a little less shiny, you know, like it puts things in perspective in a way, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Wow. You take me on quite the journey already. and I feel like I want to go back and unpack a few things in there. So your parents are like, and I get this because this is not an uncommon story. My parents are the children of immigrants, and interestingly, we're allowed and encouraged to study art, because I know that that's not common, like you're describing. Mm-hmm. So you don't study art, but did you know you were an artist or interested in making art at that point? And we're like, well, but I can't because of my parents, I'm going to go to this, do this real job thing, study this thing that I can make a living at.
Yeah, well, psychology wasn't the thing I was going to make. So my father was a psychiatrist, right? So I was interested in psychology and I took psychology classes and like college level psychology classes when I was in high school. And my father was an incredibly kind man. Like when I think about him, it's his kindness that I think about first. And so we would have pretty long conversations about the complexity of humanity. And he always led with kindness. He's the first person who explained to me that he understood racism as a mental disorder. Mm. And one that, like COVID, which now that metaphor is really tried and true, was highly infectious. But in there is a kind of kindness, you know, he was just like, there are people who are infected with this disease and it can take them to a murderous place. And there are people who are infected with these disease and they don't even know that they're carrying it, right? Which is microaggressions, right? But to walk in the world with that sort of perspective is the kind of thing that made me say, let me study psychology, right? Like, let me try and understand the way that my father understands the world. Now I would say he actually became a psychiatrist because that was his mindset. So he was driven to that. And actually, no, I've forgotten what the question was. So I just started talking about my dad because I love him.
And it's
I bring him into every conversation.
A worthy topic and great information.
I think you were saying that your parents had this sense of like studying art was an okay thing,
which is surprising, right? And I think that is rare. I think it's more rare to have this experience. Like when I said I wanted to, I didn't see art as a valid career path, but mm-hmm. but because my parents were artists, not because they, it was the opposite. They were artists and I was like, right, but you both teach and do other things because you don't see that as a way to make a living. And I was very practical and I was like, I need to make a living. And so yeah. I was like, I'll study something practical, theater design, which was
At least
had a job title and some people got hired to do it, whereas no one got hired to be a fine art painter as far as I could tell. And so I was just was like, okay, well, I'll do something adjacent. But you did something completely other.
Yeah. You know, I want to unpack the immigrant experience too, because I have to tell you that when I am almost anywhere else in the world, like when I'm in Europe, I spend a lot of time in Italy. Now I have dear friends who live in Italy, so I go there quite often, but I sort of love hate Italy, but that's another conversation. I love my friends there, but the things about Italy that I think we all hold up, Italy, like this wonderful, wonderful place. And this isn't anything to take away from the culture and the people and the richness of the culture, but the things that people go to see, it's just like, So about 1492, and like cutting off indigenous people's hand for gold and all this gold that's here, that's what I see.
Right. I mean, there's like, a backstory.
Like,
we're not.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, and let's talk about how the Roman Empire was built on the backs of slavery, not racialized slavery, but on the backs of slavery. Like, let's actually unpack what we're celebrating here. It's a little bit like the Queen's Jubilee. It's like, okay, right. Well, like really, what story are we telling? But I will say that when I am in Italy and my friends introduce me as an artist, people lean in, they're actually interested in that, right? And here, when I say that I'm an artist, this is what I get, you know, the sort of like our real artist, like do you show your artwork? People just want to know how you make money, right? And they want to know if you make money or if you're famous, right? And when I'm in other places, people, I mean, it's like if I said I was a poet, people would understand this as a way of holding culture and how important that is. And many places, not everywhere in the United States, but many places in the US, we're so focused, it's such a capitalist economy that people are like, but I need to understand your worth in terms of fame and how much money is in the bank, right? And it's like, this is not my worth, right?
But we're, we are steeped in that, right? To the point, like I'm saying, that like, I was like, I've got to be practical. And to your point, when I, you know, went to France for the first time as a kid, my family got an opportunity to stay at a studio and spend some real time there. And the same thing happened where they were like, oh, you're artists, you're teachers. These are the most important jobs. And you're like, what? Like,
exactly.
Oh my God. Like it's such a sharp shock when you've only been in American culture and not realized the striking difference there is between.
And it's not all of American culture, right? Because of course, America is very complicated, but you know what I'm saying? Like that,
for sure.
Sort of like, you know, like, are you famous? And I was like, to the people who know me.
there's a lot of versions of it.
Like to my friends and family and a couple of people on Instagram, you know, like, I don't know how to answer that question. But to say the same thing with my parents, like as soon as someone was paying me to do the work that I do and that I had a title that they could share, then it felt like, okay, like we made lots of sacrifices and you'll be okay.
Right.
Like,
so it was legitimized, but also they were concerned for you, like you said, that, you know, as parents are,
yeah,
you
want your kids to be the best for their kids
and that you're going to be able to take care of yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful. I had parents who wanted the best for me. I mean, I said parents want their best for their kids, but not every parent does. Right.
Fair enough. Yeah.
There are abusive parents out there, parents who don't care and love for their kids. And I came from a family that I was loved and cared for. Right. So, so there's gratitude in that, but you also understand that there's a kind of complexity there.
Yeah.
You know, if we lived in Canada, just a little north of where I am, if you're an artist, they give you a stipend.
Oh my God.
Like they understand that you're an artist. So here's at least this much money. So you have a way to live and support yourself at least a little bit. Cause we know that the system is, you know, crooked.
Right? Yeah. Like, I mean, it's hard to imagine that life because I think about how much of my time is spent trying to make sure I've got income.
And if
I spent that time on creation, what more would I create? What more would exist because of that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's getting depressing. So let's talk about you. No, but
well,
so
it's not depressing in the way that there are models out there and we can think as creative people, like, what are those models? So when someone comes to me in the era of Zoom,
we are currently on Zoom.
Yes. I mean, this is a slightly different situation. And people were having this, some people were having this racial reckoning, like they suddenly realized that America is a racist place. Every time that happens, I'm just like, good for recognizing this. This is not new. This is
right.
This
you're like,
is what how is this nation was built. This is actually foundational to the nation, but I'm glad that you see it. Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like the number of people who would say, we need to make sure that we have more artists of color, giving talks or speaking to our students and all of that. And it's in the Zoom era. So we want to make sure that we're suddenly now like, ah, this needs to be a more diverse pool of people that we're speaking to, but it's Zoom. So, we would like to pay you $1.50 for your labor.
Right.
And the number of times I said, I am not doing that. And also do not ask any other melanated people to do this, right? Like pay people better than that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is sort of this capitalist urge, but it's also this sense of like, understanding that people's labor is valuable.
Yes.
So I mean that's sort of like the flip side of what we're talking about, right? You know, it's like so actually valuing that labor and that creativity and making sure that someone can pay their bills.
Yeah. No, I mean, we could go far down this track because I think, you know, it says a lot about a society with what you choose, what you value, who you choose to pay the most to, and what those jobs are, what that says what the society values. So we know what America values. It's very clear.
So you
get this other degree, you go off and work for a couple years, and then you say, I'm going to go back to grad, back to undergrad.
Right. So I'm at my alma mater now. I landed here sort of unintentionally, but I'm teaching at Amherst College, and have been here for now 5 years. Came here just as a visitor while I was on kind of a sabbatical from VCU, and then they wouldn't let us leave. Daryl, my husband, and I met at Amherst College. Oh. We got married many years later, but we met at Amherst College, and we're both here. So that's a nice thing. And when I went to Amherst, Amherst was a difficult place to get into. And I went to a prep school in DC called Sidwell Friends. And you know, it's a place that I say it paved the path for the Obama girls to go there. But it's one of the private schools in DC that is, you know, has a reputation for as a Quaker school for teaching people ethically, but also it is a prep school. So, you know, I, in my class, like 8 people went to Harvard and, you know, 6 people went to Princeton, and, you know, a whole bunch of us went to like places like Amherst and Williams and Wesleyan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Like it was that kind of institution. So, we all did well on our SATs, like, you know, all of that stuff, right? and then I came here and got this degree and worked at a boarding school for a couple of years because I knew I was interested in education. So I worked at a boarding school for a couple of years and saved my pennies. It was like the richest I ever felt because it was free housing. And if you wanted to eat in the cafeteria, which I never did, you know, there was free food. And I wasn't getting paid very much, but I had really not many expenses. So it was like, I felt very rich. But right before I took that job, my parents' graduation present from Amherst was to send me on an art trip to West Africa. And so I was in the Ivory Coast or Cote d'Ivoire, and I studied textiles there. Hmm. And that trip made me say, this is actually what I want to do, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to go back and take this job and I'm going to work. And now I really want to, like, I've done all the right things, you know.
So it kind of lit the match.
Yeah, I did the right things. I will always have that college degree from Amherst that you know, that's fine. Yeah. And I know how to get a job, so that's also fine. But now I really want to know more about how embodied knowledge manifests itself in art forms, like long old art forms that are normally under the canopy of craft. Hmm. And for me, that was textiles in particular. Hmm. And so I started looking at textile programs, right? And trying to teach myself how to do some things in textiles, right? And then I applied to art school, and, you know, art schools are just like, sure, we'll take your money.
And you say this is a long time.
I shouldn't say that.
No, you say this is a long time art school teacher, so you know.
Yeah. I don't mean to be so flippant, but
no, it's true.
They teach, the Art Institute of Chicago treated me like a transfer student, right? So I'd taken all my liberal arts degrees. So they said, you just have to take studio art classes. And at the Art Institute of Chicago, studio art classes meet all day. So if you take a class, it meets like all day on Monday, right? With a lunch break. And it feels like being in a studio, wow. Right? Like all day.
That sounds like a graduate school experience.
I mean, it's one of the things I loved about the Art Institute of Chicago, because your teacher would teach you something and then you'd like work it out with a bunch of people all during the day, right? Wow. And then there were no grades, right? So the way that you could fail there is simply by not showing up. That's how you failed. But if you showed up, you pass the class.
You were good. Wow.
Yeah. So show up. And if you're going to show up, then you're probably going to do this all day long. And they always said, at the time that I was there, they said, don't take more than 3 studio classes, right? You know, so 3 full days a week that you were in the, you know, studio classes, and then maybe like 1 liberal arts class. But I'd taken all my liberal arts classes and I was paying. So it's like, I'm going to take 5 studio art classes. So I was in studio all week long.
Wow.
So it was very immersive and I loved it. And then went straight to graduate school after that. Wow. So I was only at the Art Institute of Chicago for two years in the summer.
Oh, wow. But yeah, it sounds like you got everything out of it. And I find that with older students, like when you come back to school and you're paying yourself, you know what you're there for and you're going to grab every ounce of it. And you did, which is awesome.
You're not doing it for someone else. You're doing it for yourself, right?
And you knew you wanted to be there. It was a passion at this point.
Yeah. Well, it was a curiosity.
Okay.
Like it felt like a passion, and then it helped fan the flames of that passion into, you know, something like, well, I know I need to have art in my life. I should also say that while I was there, one of my teachers was Nick Cave, who was a dear friend, not the musician.
Yeah, I know who. I actually just saw a show in Chicago. I was actually just in Chicago and I saw a show.
Yeah, and so he was a young artist at the time, because this is many years ago. This is in the early 90s. And what a privilege for me to have been there while he was on this visiting artist, in this visiting artist role, just a 3-year position that he was in. And he became a mentor. He's like an older brother. He's a dear friend. To have him as a teacher was like, I was so lucky. Like I was just there at a really good time. And I had amazing teachers there and amazing fellow students. And it was really expensive, so I needed to get out of there quickly.
So now your parents, or was it your dad specifically, said you have to do grad school?
Right.
So you were obliged.
Then I knew
to
I was going to apply to a grad school in art. Like it didn't take me long to figure out that that's what the grad school was going to be. And I did get it. I did get, when I went to Cranbrook, I did get scholarships to go to Cranbrook. I got a couple of scholarships. One scholarship at the Art Institute of Chicago, which allowed me to go to Indonesia for an art and study trip. And so that's one of the things that is also deeply important to my practice, is this idea of being out in the world, sort of shedding the titles that might be in the place, be, you know, attributed to me in this place, this place being the US, and then being somewhere else and just being sort of an unknown and maybe an oddity, you know, like traveling. And like when I was in China, I've only been in China once, but when I was there in the mid 2000s, 2005, I think it was, I felt so tall and melanated as a woman. I was just like, I am a giant here, right? I am a giant brown person in this place, right? Like I was such an oddity it was just this wonderful way of understanding. Wonderful sometimes. Wonderful way of understanding things. Also being in a place where I was completely illiterate. And realizing like it sharpened my eyes. So you're just like in a culture, deep old culture, where you can't read anything, but how do you read? And how much is your cultural reading? And how much is like your human reading? And how much is like what I learned yesterday that I'm now applying to understanding this situation today? So having the experience of walking into a high-end hardware store, like a Restoration Hardware store, and thinking that I was going into a restaurant, and then stepping back out, and I was like, what happened there?
I had a similar experience in Japan, because it's similarly, you can't, if you do not know Japanese, you cannot read a single thing.
Right.
You are an alien. It is not your place. You are clearly not from there. They know you're not. And it is an amazing experience. And it is one that it's profound to be able to like have that rare moment of like, wow, I can look at things totally different and have that experience. Yeah. I had a friend there who took me somewhere to a restaurant, and I would like, I didn't know that was a restaurant. I would never have walked in that door. I don't even know how to operate that door. because there was like a thing that turned, I was like, I don't even know how that works. Like, that's how alien this was, like, ow. So yes, I-
Yeah, and then coming home to the place that I was born on the part of the planet, you know, that the generations of my, I am a first generation American, but as my mother would always say, Columbus didn't discover anything, but he also never set foot on the continental US. Anyway, so I'm like, right. So to come home and say, like, I ain't an alien here though, right? You know, so like that kind of, you know, when you see that othering in your homeland, you're just like, you know, I'm not tolerating that bullshit.
Yeah.
Sorry, I won't curse anymore.
You can. It's quite all right.
Oh, now you shouldn't have told me that.
Oh no, right. Is this the real you's coming out words?
I will try and you know.
I'm used to being on the radio, so I know how to keep that in. But on a podcast, you can do anything you want. So, well, let's jump forward because I feel like I could spend the whole time just talking about education.
I'm looking at the time. Yeah.
And so you went through grad school. So I don't want to talk too deeply about it, other than, what do you think you got out of grad school? Like, what was that for you? What was the purpose of that as an artist? I didn't go to grad school, so I'm always fascinated by the art grad school thing, because I always feel like I missed something by not doing it. What do you feel like you brought up?
You might have missed something, but you might have gained something else. So, yeah. You know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, yeah, I missed something by going to graduate school that you have by not going to graduate school, you know? I don't think there's one path for artists, but I will share with you that I went to graduate school where no less than three of my teachers had gone. So Nick Cave had gone to Cranbrook, Ann Wilson had gone to Cranbrook, and Joan Livingstone, who I was a studio assistant for, had also gone to Cranbrook. They were all teachers of mine in the fiber department at the Art Institute of Chicago. So that sort of following in the legacy of your mentors and teachers. And I did that. At the time, Cranbrook's been around for a while, but Nick was one of the few Black students who had graduated from that particular department. I felt very empowered when I was at Cranbrook, but I also, and part of that power came from the fact that Cranbrook is a few miles north, half an hour, 40 minutes from Detroit. And so much of my education at Cranbrook came from the Black art community in Detroit, in conjunction with what was lacking in the really white ivory tower that was Cranbrook. When I arrived at Cranbrook, someone said to me, one of my teachers actually said to me, you know, Black students tend not to do well here.
Oof.
And my response to that, because, you know, I felt very empowered and I know who I am and who the people that I come from said, is that supposed to be a reflection on me or on you, right? I mean, to me, that sounds like you failed Black students. That doesn't sound like Black students fail, you know? Yeah. Right? And that teacher and I had a learning moment. I was just like, oh, I just taught you something. Like, you don't see who I am and the legacy of who I'm coming from. You don't understand who I'm walking with. And yet, let me hold up a mirror. And I actually expect my students to do the same thing with me when I falter in my teaching, when I underestimate their ability, when the isms that exist within me arise. I hope that they too will hold up a mirror so that I can be a better teacher, right? For them and the people that are coming after them. I hope that to be true. So this is not a story of shaming. This is a story of how, even in an educational institution that was not intending for my presence to be there, right? We can shape the institutions to a certain amount, and they'll push back, but shape the institutions to a certain amount. But it was also a good learning experience for me to understand how the art world might receive me. both the art world, and I should say the art worlds, both the way that that the National Conference of Artists, which is a Black organization, embraced me and gave me my first solo show before my thesis show at Cranbrook, and how that community in that first solo show held a conference that meant that my artwork was acquired by a museum, right? So that community, I was just like, great. And then the predominantly white community that was Cranbrook was teaching me also all of these things. You know, I had classmates who would say things like, oh, you're so lucky to be Black because there are all these Black art shows. And I was like, you realize that's because like the X nomination of, I know that's like a million-dollar word, but the unnamed, I mean, like the difference between American and African American means white American and Black American. Like you have the American means white. So
right.
Like, you know, all these art shows, and then like Black people have to claim some space because you all are not including us. And we have plenty of culture that doesn't need you either. Like both of those things simultaneously. So that, that sort of learning environment of double consciousness was really important and formative for who I am as an artist and an educator, and the political stance that I take.
Yeah.
In the artwork. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see how that helps you navigate the world that you're, that we're in now. So yeah, for sure.
What's heartbreaking is that I hear that students are going through the same thing now. Like, it's
still,
just like, really?
Still.
Because that was 30 some years ago. And
yes, I feel it because every time we hit these things, and I, my, you know, my mom was an activist, and you know, it's like, it's heartbreaking when she's like, really, like, we're doing this again, like we haven't gotten any, it feels like we're just, we haven't taken a step forward. She remembers back in the day, and now we're, and here we are yet again. And so yeah, I
well, this is where education matters. I mean, when you see white supremacists, the last gasp, you know, like these ridiculous notions of replacement theory, banning books and all of that, you know, the fascism that is rising in the nation, but has always had its tentacles in this. I mean, fascists learned how to, they got a significant part of their playbook from the way that America treated Black people, right? And so, seeing that, you can say it's my friend and the great curator and museum director, Lowry Stokes Sims, said it's the last gasp, you know, but it, man, is it ugly. Whew. and dire, like lives being lost. Just, you know, I mean, if we start talking about what's in the news, this really is going to be a depressing conversation, but the people are just like, we can't teach, we can't use 1619 as a book because that is very dangerous. But but yeah, we can have guns in school. In fact, teachers should have guns. And you just,
yeah, I mean, the disconnect just, is
like,
is,
what madness is this?
Yes.
And people worried about losing their political base by spewing this. I mean, like, there is no logic in this. There's no logic.
It is incredibly cynical. It is so
the craziness of
this. Yeah. No, we're on the same page.
I know.
Well, okay. So we're going to take it back to art.
Yes.
Right. Even though this does directly correlate, because your work is, you know, deeply rooted in your ethics and history and beliefs. But I want to talk about this sort of other side, which is the practical side of being an artist. So you, out of grad school, chose to become a teacher as well as an artist who is exhibiting work in museums. Where there's a practical side to that, right? There's a job when you're teaching as an artist, and that's what my parents did. Mm-hmm. Was there a version of you who was like, I want to just be somehow making a living at, and I'm making big assumptions here, that you that making a living as an artist versus making a living as a teacher and then making art, and that way it's, you're not driven sort of by the commodity side of art versus like a, maybe a gallery artist or even a crafts person who's making their living selling craft, right? In sort of a different
So, there's a lot to touch in there. So first, I will tell you that in high school, I worked at a very, very sort of fancy boutique in DC. So I had this sort of retail experience, right? But in a very fancy place in DC. And when I got out of grad school, so this is, so that was high school. So now I have my high school degree, two undergraduate degrees, and a master's degree. And the job I got was working at Macy's. Right? So a department store, which, you know, to my high school self was definitely a step down, right? But that was a job that I got. And the idea was that I was going to work, live with my now husband, who was working in a boarding school. So we had a place to live, right? And it was a pretty liberal boarding school. So they didn't mind that we weren't married. The only thing that they said was, you all are planning to get married. Can you just give us a date for the parents who are more conservative, right? So we said, yeah, we'll get married on this date and all of that. And so I did work at, I just want to say, like, my first job out of all of those degrees was to work at Macy's. Nice. And I did it for a few months, and Daryl begged me to stop, because he said, you're giving all your nice to your customers, and there's not as much nice left when you come home.
Feel bad.
And then I would just work in our little, there was a little, I don't think it was even big enough to call it a bedroom, but I would make artwork there, right? So I always had this sense of like, I had to have a job to support my art practice as I was developing my art practice. And then the next job I had right after that, the reason I quit Macy's, is that I got an adjunct position, two actually, one at the Maryland Institute College of Art and one at a place that was called PCTA, Pennsylvania College of Textiles and Art or something like that. Now I think it's called Liberty University or something. It's been rebranded, but a place in Philadelphia, and a place in Baltimore. And I lived about 40 miles north, working at this boarding, where the boarding school where Daryl was working, outside of Philadelphia. So I was commuting, right? But getting my teaching chops up. And the reason I got those two teaching jobs were Cranbrook connections, right? Mm. So graduate school served that purpose, that I belonged to an art community. And I am grateful to that art community that I belong to. I also belong to this art, you know, like multiple art communities, right? So the Cranbrook art community that got me my first job, the Detroit Black art community that got me my first solo show and my first sales to museums, right? You know, like these are, so I'm like, okay, all right, what we got here? Let's get this going, right? And got married. And then my first like full-time job was a sabbatical replacement. So I left my husband to take a job in Kansas City, Missouri at the Kansas City Art Institute and worked there for a year. We thought it would just be a year. We'd known each other, Daryl and I had known each other for a long time. We were young, we figured we can commute. This is a great opportunity. He had a job, I had a job. They just weren't in contiguous states, but you know, there were airplanes, thankfully. So, we didn't have much money. We spent a lot of money on airplanes to see each other. And then from there, I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and still commuted. So I have given a lot for art. I mean, Daryl and I commuted for, depending on how you count, 12 years. Wow. As married, as people who were in a relationship together. 12 years of not living, of living flying distance apart.
That's crazy.
Not like New York, Philly, Philly, Boston, or any of those cute
things. Yeah. you're like, you have a layover.
Far.
Wow, amazing. And you're still together. Made it.
Yeah, well, then when we came to VCU, we were working together, and now we're at Amherst and we're together. And I, you know, to me, that's a young person's game. Right? I don't know how people do it. I do know people who laugh at our commute, like, yeah, but we live in London and New York, and I'm like, okay, you win.
Yeah. So you sort of figured out this way for you, which is teaching, And then you continue to develop your art practices. And you've obviously, so I mean, hearing that you got, you know, museum acquisition in grad school, like you're already at this level of sort of achievement as an artist very early on. And
yeah, so I want to also say that opportunity happens. Like, I feel like ancestors were looking out for me. So the Detroit community, I got to know the Detroit Detroit art community, because right before, this is a lot of stuff, but right before I went to grad school, I did an apprenticeship at the Fabric Workshop and Museum, right, in Philadelphia. And one of the artists, so I was, you know, making screens for people who were doing projects, like real artists who were doing projects, like Ann Hamilton. It's where I met Ann Hamilton. And it's also where I met Shirley Woodson, who is an amazing artist and friend and mentor. And this is this Black woman from Detroit. And so when I told her I was going to Cranbrook, she said, make sure you call me when you get to town. And she was the president of the National Conference of Artists. You see how that's like complete serendipity? Mm-hmm. Like if I wasn't at the Fabric Workshop at that time, right, when she was there, then I wouldn't have met her. Then I wouldn't have felt connected to that. I wouldn't have had the invitation. She's a very generous person. And she herself, a high school art teacher for many, many, many years at Cass Tech, really well-respected school there, public school there. And she with open arms said, come, you know, like you're part of our community, right? And that's what led to me having my first solo show and that they had a conference and that this museum happened to be there. So is that my artwork or is that like a lot of we are each other's magnitude and bonds, you know, to sort of quote Gwendolyn Brooks, you know, like this way in which we take care of each other, but there's also like this serendipity of something that's much larger than us, right? So it's not that my work was so amazing. It's that I had I really feel like the universe was taking care of me. My work wasn't bad. You know, was good enough.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. I would contend that your work is good. You have to have both.
A lot of people looking out for me, right?
Well, no, I say you have to have both because you can have not good art but great connections. You can have great art and bad connections. Like it does have to. You have to have the right formula for it to add up.
Right.
And So, gosh, we could talk for hours and hours.
So to me, always teaching and being an artist, that's the crux of your question, like that balance.
Yeah.
I had been teaching for a long time. When I was a middle schooler, I was very good at math. Now I can barely add, but I was really good at math. And my mom's hairdresser, who also I guess was my hairdresser for better or worse, but her son was being held back. And my mom said, well, Sonia's good at math. So she can tutor him. And I taught him all of these tricks that I had learned, like literally like patterns, so that he could learn his times tables without it just being memorization. I was just like, oh, this is what happens. Like the one times table and the nine times table are connected. They just sort of reverse each other in this way. Like all this sort of pattern recognition stuff that learned somewhere. I don't know where I learned it, not Montessori, but somewhere, you know, or recognized, and shared it with this little boy who's probably like just a few years younger than I am. And to watch him have this pride and know that he learned something. And I was just like, it filled my heart, right? So I was like, I want more like that. You know, so education is really important to me. Teaching is really important to me, and my students make me a better artist and make me a better teacher. And I, you know, sort of acknowledging that before. So it's a hard thing. Like I could not teach now. Also, real talk. Like I could pay my bills.
Well, and that was going to be my next question is, you know,
the generous, I have a very, Amherst treats me very, very well. Amherst College treats me very well. And so, but I like teaching people who this is going to sound a little weird. VCU, I taught students who thought of themselves as artists. That's why they came to VCU. Now I'm in a liberal arts school, and I'm with students who don't necessarily think of themselves. Most of the students don't think of themselves as artists. They're very caught up in other things, you know, like aspirational things. How are they going to change the world and make a living? Maybe not even in that order, depending on the student. I love teaching students who are trying to get into my classes, you know, and the students who will say, oh, you're teaching a beading class. I've been beading for 20 years. I'm like, not as interested in you. I'm a little interested, but why would you take a class? That sounds like you already know.
Right.
I mean, you could teach me a thing or two. So, right. Okay. And of course, they haven't been beating 20 years. They are 20 years old. Right. But let me just say a little brief thing. That particular class that I'm talking about had attracted a number of Indigenous students and then a number of Native American students, of which Amherst has some, but not enough. You know, it's a community that is a rich community, but we only have representation of a very few of the many nations of Indigenous people from this land. And so those students, I was just like, okay, you can, yeah.
you step up.
Come. Because we're all gonna teach each other and this is gonna be great. And so a couple of those students who have some, you know, already previous prior knowledge, but also I like love the student who didn't know how to thread a needle before the class.
Right.
Like, I want those students in there. I want them all together. And that student who didn't know how to thread a needle ended up doing the best, you know, like was at the top of that class. Because one of the things that I value in that class is just like, okay, so we're going to be rating things on skill, but we're also going to be rating things on ingenuity. So the most skilled student might not have any ingenuity or improvisational ability, right? So that student's going to say, like, what did you do? Like, you could barely thread a needle, but what did you just do, right? So one student who had all of the, came with a sort of like all this improvisational ability and ingenuity, but didn't know how to thread a needle, like learned the skills and just rose to the top of the class. And I said, so you see that, right? Like, I can teach you skills, right? But we don't fan the flames of ingenuity. Then,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Well,
then that's
okay.
Just skills.
Yes.
Right?
So I want to, there's several points here I think that are good to emphasize. One, right, is you choose to teach. And
but
that it's not, yeah. It's not this just the job so you can do art. It's something you find, you get from it. And that you find this, and you know, there's this learning component to it, but also that it is something, I guess what I'm trying to express is that I have a similar thing around needing this balance between art making and then this other piece, this teaching piece. And I teach in a corporate setting. I do work with people that are, in executives. And what's interesting in similar sense is that my favorite people to teach, right? Every now and then I work with like a creative group.
Yeah.
And they're frustrated with me teaching them. They think they're the experts, and they don't like that I'm giving them some weird thing to do. You know, I know this already. You know, you're not, what do you know? But if I come into a room full of people who feel completely uncomfortable that this is out of their realm of knowledge, that they're experts in other things, they're the best because they don't have any preconceived notions, and it's fun, and there's surprise, and we all learn something, like you're saying. And so what do you say to the people who are, you know, non-artists about why art is important then? Like, what's the value of this to those folks who haven't grown up with this and studied this and embraced this?
Well, what I would say is, first of all, I think people have a very, very, very narrow definition of what art is.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I was saying in the top of the hour, that when I ask students to introduce themselves, and there's a little bit more to that, by their first artful experience, some of them will lock into like museum, famous white guy, right? And I'm like, painter, right? Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. Like, it gives me an opportunity to like unpack what artful moment means and what art means.
Right, right.
And, why we're privileging that space over some other space and all of that, right? So first of all, like sticking elbows out and saying like, let's talk about what art actually is, right? And then when that definition is as broad as I think it should be, and then it's like, okay, so now we have this very broad definition. Now take all the art out of the world. What do you have left? It ain't much. Right? And so there's a reason why they, and here I mean, again, to turn to politics for a moment, white supremacists, fascists, those who want to control and subjugate, because that's the only way that they understand that they can have relevance. Get rid of the poets, the musicians, and the artists, right? And there I mean like the visual artists, you know, like all of the art fields. Because a protest song, you can cut someone's tongue out, but they still have the song in their heart, right? You can have an image that can move people. It can move them to tears. It can move them to action. It can move, have an image. And you could, I don't mean to be so violent, but there is such violence in the world, in this world. You could gouge someone's eyes out and they still have that image in their mind's eye, right? A poem, and the poets to me, if I could come back as something else, I don't think I've earned it in this life, but if I could come back as something else, it would be a poet. The way in which a Toni Morrison or a writer like, I was talking about Gwendolyn Brooks earlier, a poet like Gwendolyn Brooks, a writer like Imani Perry can fold a metaphor inside of a metaphor, right? In the span of 7 words, right? The way that Ocean Vuong can like, I read a page and I have to shut the book because I'm like, it's like I'm so full, right? Like that's the power of the arts. Of course, I turn to the literary arts because it's easier for me to talk about like an art form that I have absolutely no skill or mastery in, right? And to acknowledge that and say like, that's why they come after us, because that's where the power actually is. So the subjugation is just like, when you see people needing to subjugate, look to who they're subjugating, because what they're actually saying is that's where the power is. And we're scared of that power. So when you see people subjugating indigenous people, people of color, immigrants, you know, it's just like, that's because they know that's where the power is, right? And when I think about American culture, you know, and I think about the heritages that have built American culture, I mean, one of the things I love about 1619 is just like, try and have American culture without the people that were subjugated. And you don't have American culture. you just don't have it. Yeah. This is the importance of art. And to turn to this other side of it, the capacity for art to hold all of our humanity. And so not just I'm thinking about specifically I'm trying to find like the right words, but the public lynching of George Floyd. He was not the first, and he clearly was not the last. I'm thinking about how there's a way in which people wanted to capture the pain, like the number of times people came to me as a Black artist and saying, what are you feeling now? What are you making now? What are you doing? And I was like, this is the same as before. So if you look at my other work, you will see that. But also, can we not just monetize Black pain? Because there is also the complexity of emotions and ways of being, and that is our humanity. And if our humanity is only monetized and capitalized through our pain, then what that will do is just like, oh, we need more pain for those people so we can have some more art, as opposed to through our joy, through our complexity, through our messiness, through everything. Like, I need you all to see the fullness of the humanity and the complexity of all the identities that we have and the diversity in our diversity. And then if you can see that in the artwork, then we can talk. But so that, I mean, I think about all of that as art's purpose. And there's a poet out there who probably could say that in a haiku.
Right. So let's bring it back from the, we have only a little bit of time left. Bring it back from the very big to you. Do you feel successful?
Do I feel successful? In moments, but it's not my goal, actually. So you said you bring it back to me. And remember that even when I'm thinking of me, I say this to people all the time, like there is no way that you can really feel lonely. And I don't mean this about people who are suffering from depression and are actually, you know, someone who is in a psychological state where they do actually feel lonely. But when I mean it sort of more metaphorically, is that this person right here was made up of like millions and millions of people, right? Like literally millions of people, like two parents who keep going back multiple generations and, it's like to the power of, I don't know, 100. It's like a lot of people. And then mixed up in that is, you and I are relatives. Like, we have common ancestors. I mean, I often say people of African descent. And I was like, if the anthropologists have that right, that's everybody, right? But so the individual self, I actually think the artwork is the more important thing. So I'm not really so concerned with my success as what it means, like really not so concerned with that, because I think that can be very distracting. I think I would be making other work if my goal was the way that we think about success in this capitalist. I mean, like, I think I know what that work might be. I think I know how I could make that work, but I would be relinquishing something of my ethics and something of my responsibility to the legacy that I belong to if I focused on myself and my own success. I actually want to make artwork that I don't even care if people know that I made it, but the artwork has like, who made this? Oh, Sonia Clark. It's not important, but that the artwork facilitates some sort of change and catalyst well after I'm gone, right? And so that's a kind of, it's a kind of immortality, I guess, but it's more immortality in the idea, right? Because the idea feels like a gift, right? And the idea can live far longer than the bones and blood and breath that is Sonia Clark. And so again, it doesn't even matter if it's Sonia Clark, because first of all, Sonia Clark is a bunch of people that arrived at this being, right? So it feels like just continuing that legacy. So when I make something and it has resonance with someone for a moment, for a time period, for longer than that, or it resonates again and again and again and again. That's a kind of success, but not for me, for the legacy that I belong to. When that happens, that feels that feels special, but I'm also not there to witness it. You know, artwork lives in a space, in someone's home, in a museum or something like that. I'm not there in someone's mind and heart to know how the artwork does or doesn't speak to them, right? And this is what I mean. Like, I don't know whether it's successful, because there could be a child who sees a big 15 by 30 foot woven cloth, and they say, that's the biggest piece of cloth I've ever seen in my whole life. And then they find out, or their parents tell them from reading something, like, that's the piece of cloth that an artist, forget her name, but decided to make 100 times its scale. That's a piece of cloth that ended the Civil War. Let's talk about the Civil War. Let's talk about what surrender means. Let's talk about what truce means. Let's talk about where the Civil War was fought. And so this piece of cloth now becomes a story, right? And that story is actually that the artwork has the ability to hold all of those stories that I am not witness, I can't bear witness to. And that feels like success, but not mine. Not mine. You know, like I can claim some of it, but that's not the important part. It feels like the art itself has had a moment or a glimmer of success, but I'm not there to witness it. So, you know, if someone walks by, I'm also not there to witness that. And those unsuccessful moments, right? Anyway, yeah, that's my thought on that.
I love it. I love your perspective. Thank you so much for the generosity of your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's so wonderful to talk to you. And thank you for making this space. And as always, I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
And in all of your endeavors, all of them creative and as a partner and as a father and all of those things, as a son, all of those things, all the ways that you walk in this world. So again, thank you for inviting me. And I hope our conversation will be fruitful for others.
Thanks for listening to Foreground Background with me, Noah Scalin. If you want to know more about Sonia Clark, check out her site, soniaclark.com, which will be in the show notes. If you want to help me make more things like this show, please consider becoming part of my team art at patreon.com/noahscalin. And of course, please rate and review this podcast wherever you found it. This show is edited by Kelsey Dvorak. Thank you, Kelsey. And the music used on this episode is Flying High 2019 Hip Hop Remix by Jantrax. And finally, a special thank you to all of my Patreon supporters. You help make this show possible. You all rock.